Oh, I have to consent to being recorded. Okay, cool. I consent. Excellent. Right. So just by way of introduction, my name is Fergus Boyles. As Garrett mentioned, I'm a research software engineer in the Oxford Protein Informatics Group here in the Department of Statistics. And prior to that, I was a DPhil student in the Department of Statistics. So I've been around for a while. And today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the use of machine learning in drug discovery. And I'm going to touch on quite a few topics, both things that I've worked on and things that other people have worked on. But certainly the latter half of the talk is really going to be focusing on examples of research done either by myself or by other members of the Oxford Protein Informatics Group. So this is by no means intended to be an exhaustive discussion of all of the things that people have done using machine learning in drug discovery. That would take an entire course and you probably still wouldn't do all of it. But I hope that this will give you some idea as to how computational methods in general, but machine learning in particular, is really benefiting the drug discovery process and what the practical implications of that are. So just a brief overview of what I'm going to talk about. I'm aware that this is very much a statistics audience. So I'm going to open with just an introduction to the drug discovery process, what it entails, why we care about it, why we might want to apply computational methods to it at all. And then I'll briefly introduce the concept of computer-aided drug design and discuss sort of prior to the machine learning hype train or revolution, depending on your stance on it, what sort of computational methods have historically been employed. And then I'll give some examples of sort of well-established machine learning techniques in drug discovery, what they're used for, what sort of problems they accomplish, why it's beneficial over other methods. And then towards the end, I'd like to spend some time highlighting recent developments in drug discovery that have really benefited from recent advancements in deep learning techniques. So just before I start, I'm aware that quite a few people in this audience are either members of OPIG or have been through the Doctoral Training Center in some capacity. So I'm aware you may have seen the introduction to drug discovery talk anywhere between 1 and 50 times before. So if you want to tab out for the first 10 minutes, I won't be offended. So just to get us started, what is drug discovery? To really answer that question, we first need to understand, so what is a drug? We intuitively know, think of a drug as, it's a medicine. We take a medicine to cure ourselves, but what actually are drugs? So biological processes, infection and disease are just the result of the behavior of macromolecules in the body. Proteins perform pretty much every task in the body. Specific proteins have specific functions. If they're carrying that function out correctly, the body is doing okay. If a protein starts to misbehave or functions too much or too little, or a foreign body like a virus introduces a foreign protein into the body, bad things can happen. This is how you get diseases. This is how you get symptoms of infection. So the key to trying to treat or manage diseases or infections is really trying to figure out what is causing the problem and how can we either make that molecule behave properly or stop that molecule doing the thing it's not supposed to do. And so in pharmaceutical research, we have this concept of a drug target. And a drug target is a key molecule. It's typically a protein or occasionally a nucleic acid that has been implicated an infection or disease. And this can be a protein, as I said, a protein in the body that's misbehaving, or a protein that's part of, for example, the life cycle of a virus. And I'll get into an example of both of these in just a moment. And then there are all sorts of ways of identifying and validating whether a target is indeed implicated in a condition that I'm not going to go into today. That's really a topic of research in and of itself. But the key idea is that in order to treat disease, we want to target usually a protein, occasionally a nucleic acid in the body, and alter or inhibit its function. Now, a drug in in pharmacology, at least, a drug is any molecule that interacts with a drug target in order to obtain a therapeutic effect. And this could, and that therapeutic effect could be mediating a condition, managing symptoms, restoring function of a protein. It could be treating an infection by disrupting the life cycle of a pathogen, anything like that. It's really a broad catch-all. Now, just to sort of distinguish between different types of drugs, because it's an incredibly broad umbrella term, I'd like to just distinguish between two sort of key fundamental classes of drugs, and those are small molecule drugs, things such as paracetamol, you know, anything that you take in tablet form, for example. And these are small chemical compounds that are typically produced by chemical synthesis. And in contrast to this, we have a class of drugs known as biopharmaceuticals, which are an incredibly broad category of drugs that are extracted or synthesized or obtained from biological sources. And sort of the obvious topical example of this is a vaccine. And these can be, you know, potentially very large molecules, like, you know, an antibody is an entire protein. It's much larger than something like a paracetamol molecule. Today, I'm going to just focus small molecule drug discovery, but just be aware that there is an enormous field of different applications of computational methods in medical research. A concrete example of what is a drug, what is a target, how does a drug function? I'd like to start with an example of a protein in the human body. This is a protein called thrombin. And thrombin, the gray structure on the right, is an experimentally determined structure of the protein thrombin. Thrombin is an enzyme that acts as a catalyst in the blood clotting process. So in blood clotting, you have this entire cascade of biological processes that results in blood cells aggregating, which obviously, you know, it seals wounds, but also when it's misbehaving, you get conditions like blood clots, thrombosis, strokes. So it's something that we need to be very aware of. Now, an example of a drug that targets thrombin for a therapeutic effect is a peptide known as hirudin, and the structure of this is shown in cyan image on the right. And this is a naturally occurring peptide that's produced by leeches. Leeches, as we know, feed on blood. In order to feed on blood, they need to prevent the blood clotting. Their salivary glands naturally produce a peptide that binds to thrombin and stops the thrombin molecule interacting with other things because it's already interacting with the hirudin, and thereby preventing it from catalyzing the blood clotting process. And this makes hirudin useful as an anticoagulant medicine for treating things like thrombosis. And indeed, several anticoagulant drugs that are on the market are based on hirudin or chemical derivatives of it. The second example of this, we think now about pathogen. So if we think, the example I'm going to use here is the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. A key protein that plays a role in the HIV life cycle is a protein called HIV-1 protease. Now, a protease is, and again, this is an enzyme that breaks up a large chain of amino acids into distinct subunits. This is important for the life cycle of HIV protease because the proteins that are involved in the life cycle of HIV protease are produced as a single amino acid chain. So you have multiple proteins all joined together. In order for these proteins to be functional, they need to be split up into independent units. And that is the job of the HIV protease. You can see, my pointer, it has this sort of groove or channel in the middle. And this is where it sticks to the peptide chain and breaks it up. Now, in order to, and so the way antiretroviral treatments for HIV work is by inhibiting the function of HIV protease, thus preventing it from breaking up these proteins and therefore, you know, disrupting the life cycle of the virus. And the way this works is an inhibitor like indinavir, and this is the cyan molecular structure you see on the right, is designed to bind in that groove, in that binding site on the protease. The protease can't do anything to the indinavir molecule. It can't cleave it like a peptide chain. And so it just stays stuck in there, preventing the HIV protease from sticking to the peptides that it's supposed to be cleaving. thereby preventing the thereby disrupting the life cycle of the virus. And so those are just two examples of very different types of drug targets that we treat using small molecule drugs. Okay, so that's what drug is. So how do we actually develop drugs in practice? So if you've been to any drug discovery talks before, you'll have seen a variant on this diagram in one form or another. And so the pharmaceutical development process is sort of, the first thing to understand, it's a very long-winded, very expensive process. An enormous amount of time is invested just getting from identifying a target to having a candidate drug binding against that target. And that initial phase is known as drug discovery. Take anywhere from a couple of years up to over 10 years, with an average of around 4 years across UK pharmaceutical companies. But even once you have such a candidate, you then have to go through several stages of preclinical, like animal models, and clinical trials in order to verify that the drug works, that the drug's safe, that the drug's effective enough that to warrant any potential side effects. And each of these steps can take between 1 and 2 years and cost millions of pounds. And so you may end up with from target identification to actually having an improved drug on the market can take in excess of 10 years and cost well in excess of £1 billion. And so this early stage drug discovery process where you develop your drug candidates, which is what we're really going to focus on today. And so this drug discovery process, once you have a target identified, is a cyclical process of starting from a collection of compounds that you have access to, you can buy, you can make in the lab, somebody else can make for you, whatever. Taking your library of compounds and screening that entire library or a section of that library against your biological target to try and identify compounds in that library that bind to that target at all, known as hits. So in first stage, you're trying to just identify hits. And then in subsequent stages, you then take your initial hits and try to optimize both their affinity for the target, so how strongly they bind to that target, and also their selectivity, so they don't bind to other targets. And side effects of medicines are often caused by a molecule also interacting in some way with another protein other than the intended target. Off-target effects, and so trying to balance affinity and selectivity is a really important part of this process. And once you have a molecule that you think has satisfactory affinity and selectivity, you then have to go into a further process where you optimize other desirable pharmacological properties, for example, ensuring it's not toxic, ensuring that it doesn't aggregate, all the while retaining the desired affinity and selectivity. And the diagram on the right just gives a sort of really emphasizes the fact that this is a cyclical process. You identify some hits, you check for toxicity, you optimize them, you check that you can actually make the compound, because it doesn't matter how good an inhibitor it is if you can't synthesize it. And this can take many repetitive cycles. So it really is sort of a very long, very expensive, multifaceted process. So just an idea of how this is done in practice. The initial hit identification stage has traditionally been performed in a process known as high throughput screening, where you have robots in a lab that rapidly test or assay very large numbers of chemical compounds against the biological target of interest to see if any of them bind at all. And although advances in technology and methodology have continually increased the efficiency, the speed, efficiency, and reduced the cost of this process, high throughput screening in general remains a time-consuming process. Even if you can do it very quickly with certain setups, you need you need that setup in place. You need the resources to do it. You need the expertise to do it. So it's an incredibly laborious process. And so you can start to understand why drug discovery is such a slow and expensive task. Indeed, something you may have read headlines about at various points is that there's a well-known productivity problem in the pharmaceutical industry. And this is, it's been observed that despite continuous advances in technology and research methodology and increasingly available resources, the productivity of the pharmaceutical industry has continued to decline. And just to put some solid numbers on that, in 2012, a paper by Scannell et al. Showed that ever since 1950, the cost of bringing a new drug to market has doubled roughly every 9 years. And indeed, if you look at more estimates, has continued from 2012 to 2021. So it's really quite terrifying. And there are myriad reasons for this. In part, it can be attributed to marketing issues of this phenomenon known as better than the Beatles. If you're designing a new drug, it doesn't just have to work. It has to work better than anything else that we have. And it has to work sufficiently better than anything else to be worth the investment, to be worth making, to be worth marketing. And in addition to this, for a very good reason that I'll get onto in a moment, we've been observing increasingly stringent conditions and requirements from government regulators to ensure the safety and efficacy of drugs. And these really are problems that you sort of fundamentally can't address by just throwing computers at the problem. However, other problems such as inefficient resource allocation, you know, just brute forcing by throwing money at the problem, certainly contribute to this productivity crisis. And this will really try and optimize the process to bring costs down. So just an aside on why there are very good reasons for having regulations in place that increase the cost and time taken to develop a drug is a historical drug called thalidomide that you may have heard of. Now, thalidomide was initially marketed as an over-the-counter sedative in the late 1950s in Europe for things like insomnia, anxiety, and such like. And initially, it was noted as safe for use in pregnancy. However, glowing evidence in late 1950s, early 1960s linked thalidomide to birth defects in children of mothers who had been taking thalidomide during pregnancy. This led to most countries withdrawing its use in the early 1950s. However, precisely due to a lack of clear regulation, it remained in use in Spain well into the 1970s. And totally estimated that, you know, anywhere between 10 and 20,000 people are now affected by the horrific birth defects that were caused by thalidomide use. And this is really because there was really no regulation or formal requirements for proving efficacy or safety in drugs in the 1950s. Now, in the aftermath of the thalidomide tragedy, many countries introduced stricter regulations for drug testing and approval. So, for example, the UK Medicines Act of 1968 that required all current and future drugs in efficacy was a direct consequence of the thalidomide disaster. And just put some numbers on this. In the late 1950s, early 1960s, around when this was happening, there were on the order of 30 to 40,000 drugs that were available in some form in the UK, legally available in the UK. By the start of the 1990s, when all of these drugs had finally been tested in accordance with the Medicines Act, only 5,000 licensed and approved for use. So it's a really terrifying number of drugs that were just thrown onto the market with no real care for if they worked, if they were safe. So there are very good reasons that we can't just try to cut back on the clinical trials phase. We can't save time there. We can't save money there. So what can we do? Well, it turns out the very few candidates that enter clinical trials make it to the market, with most failing due to lack of efficacy or safety concerns. And this in itself contributes enormously to cost, because a successful drug has to not only pay for its own development, but for all of the work, the optimization, the development that went into the drugs that did fail. And so one thing that we can do to try and address this productivity crisis is to try and replace the expensive and laborious steps preceding clinical trials using computational methods. And there's really two aspects to this. The first is reducing the cost of designing the drug candidates by, you know, automating processes, but also improve the quality of the candidates that enter clinical trials. For example, can we predict beforehand that a molecule is going to be toxic? That immediately allows you to remove things from the clinical trials pool. So this brings us on to the concept of computer-aided drug design. So computer-aided drug design refers to any of a set of computational methods that are used in the preclinical drug discovery process in order to identify and develop your hit compounds into clinical drug candidates. And fundamentally, the goal of computer-aided drug design, or CAD, as it's often known, is to predict whether a molecule binds to a biological target. if so, how strongly? And sort of in analogy to the high throughput screening I mentioned previously, the process of applying computational methods to screen a large compound library is known as virtual screening. And just emphasize that much like traditional lab-based drug design, that this is an iterative process. You perform virtual screening, then go and try and optimize your hits from virtual screening, and then go back to a computational method to see, do I think it still binds? So again, it can carry on for quite a few iterations. And so in this talk, I'm really going to focus on the virtual screening task for much of the talk, but, and I'll mention this a few times, computer models have been successfully used for all sorts of tasks in computer-aided drug design, analyzing properties such as trying to model how is a compound going to be metabolized, is it going to be toxic, is it going to aggregate, all sorts of these things. I'll give a few examples of this later on. So just to sort of break down what virtual screening entails, you can typically break down virtual screening into two types of approaches. The first of this is ligand-based virtual screening, where you're using methods that are entirely based on the structure, position, the chemical properties of your molecules. And ligand-based virtual screening is basically the process of saying, okay, I already have some ligands that I know bind to my target of interest. So can I use that information to screen all of my other compounds to see if anything else is also likely to bind to my target of interest? You know, do I have anything that's similar to things that I know interact? So if you have some known ligands for a target, you can directly go and apply ligand-based methods. In contrast with this, we also have structure-based virtual screening, which instead uses information about the 3D structure of the biological target to predict not only if a molecule will bind, but if so, where, how is it going to bind, what interactions does it make, how strongly does it bind? And so these two methods use very different forms of information. If you have known ligands, you might use a ligand-based method. If you don't have any known ligands, but you do have a 3D structure of the protein, you might use structure-based methods. And of course, there are some quote-unquote hybrid methods that combine these two approaches when you have both of those forms of data available. And so just to give an idea of what ligand-based virtual screening entails, sort of one of the key concepts in sort of comparing screening molecules computationally is we need a way of representing a molecule in a computer, and given such a representation, a way of rationally comparing the similarity of molecules. Just give one example of how this is done is a technique known as molecular fingerprinting. The idea is we know the structure and the composition of our molecule. And on here I have the example of this is the 2D structure of a paracetamol molecule. And you got different molecules have very different sizes and shapes, so it's not necessarily clear how to compare them analytically. Molecular fingerprinting is a concept that looks at the structure of the molecule and breaks down, okay, what features are present in this molecule, what atoms are next to each other, what groups are next to each other, and converts molecules of potentially very different size and composition into a fixed length, finite size bit vector, where each bit encapsulates a certain functionality or part of the chemical structure. And once you have this sort of bit vector representation, you're now in a very good position to take any method of comparing vectors that you know, common approach or similarity searching, for example, is to compute these sorts of bit vectors for all of your molecules and then just compare your library of compounds to the fingerprints for your known molecule using a metric such as the Jacquard or Tanimoto coefficient or something else like a Dice similarity score. So this sort of approach is known as similarity searching. And this is just one way of representing a small molecule in a computer, but it's sort of this done in practice. Contrast to this, we have structure-based virtual screening, where instead we're trying to make use of the 3D structure of the target. So we might be trying to explore how the molecule might interact with the target. And there are sort of two main contrasting computational techniques that might be used for this. The first of these is a technique known as protein ligand docking, where you try to rapidly sample possible bound conformations of the ligand. So try and put in the actual site and see how do I think it might bind. You might use, for example, a Monte Carlo search algorithm to do this, and then try to rapidly estimate the binding affinity using what's known as a scoring function. I'll get onto it in more detail in just a little bit. And the key idea is you're trying to do this quickly because you have millions of compounds to screen. Now, in contrast to this sort of rapid fire approach is a technique known as molecular dynamics. Has all sorts of applications. But in this context, you fix relations of the protein ligand interactions to try and predict where does the molecule want to sit in the active site. So place it in the active site, set off the simulation, try and let it decide where it wants to sit. And based off of this, you can try and gain an understanding for, okay, what are the dynamics of binding? Because this is fundamentally a dynamic biological process, not a static snapshot. So you really want to understand those binding dynamics. And from that, try and compute, again, using physics-based force fields, try and actually compute the interaction energy or the binding affinity between the protein and the ligand. A higher affinity ligand, something that has a greater change in free energy upon binding that makes it more tightly bound, it doesn't want to separate. And that's what you're looking for in a binder, in a drug hit. So protein ligand docking is much faster than molecular dynamics. It can be orders of magnitude faster, depending on how you configure the molecular dynamics. But it sacrifices this dynamical information and sort of detailed, accurate free energy calculations for speed. And so this is always the trade-off that you're making when you're trying to efficiently screen large numbers of compounds. And in practice, protein ligand docking is the most common structure-based technique used in drug discovery, just because it's efficient. You couldn't use molecular dynamics to screen millions of compounds. That would be crazy. So just a little more on protein ligand docking, because one of the active areas of research is particularly in trying to use machine learning to improve things. So protein ligand docking, in addition to its search algorithm, it uses, as I said, what is known as a scoring function, which is a quick, dirty approximate function that tries to estimate the free energy of binding based on a single static snapshot of this is where the protein is, this is where the ligand is. And this enables, so it gives you a quick estimate of what you think the free energy allows you to rapidly assess the poses predicted by the docking algorithm, decide, do I think this is a reasonable pose? How strongly do I think it binds? Can I rank all of my different ligands by how strongly my scoring function thinks they bind? And so that lets you prioritize things that you think bind more strongly. There are many, many, many pieces of docking software that are regularly used for this process. They all have different strengths and weaknesses. I'm not going to name names here in case I upset certain people in the audience. So that was sort of all a lot of theory, but just to give an example of what a protein ligand docking result might look like in practice, if we go back to our example of thrombin and hirudin, and we have the structure of thrombin in gray, and we have an experimentally determined binding pose of the hirudin molecule in cyan, and this is determined by X-ray crystallography. Now, just using a docking algorithm to try and sample that binding pose, the best result that was returned docking algorithm is the pose in magenta, and you can see that a lot of the structure aligns very strongly. Apart from on the left, we have one ring that's sort of clearly out of place. And this is an example of the sort of quick and dirty docking scoring process that gives you a rough idea of where the molecule sits, and based on that confirmation, your scoring function will give you some estimate of the free energy of binding. So just in practice, elucidate what such a scoring function might look like, because it's really quite a key component of this process. A scoring function is any sort of approximate method that tries to estimate the free energy of binding. And sort of classically in docking, this is done as a sum of physical or empirical energy terms that are the key being that they're all easy to compute rapidly. And this might include, for example, terms that represent van der Waals potential, terms that represent Coulomb or electrostatic potentials, terms that try to quantify the energy of hydrophobic contacts, of hydrogen bonding terms, all sorts of things like this that might go on in molecular interactions. And a very common thing to do is define some of these terms, approximate them quickly, and then just use a linear regression to assign weights to each of these terms that gives you the best estimate of binding affinity that you can compute rapidly. And these really are a multi-tool of structure-based drug discovery. They're used to determine whether a docked pose is physically reasonable, that it used to rank ligands by the likelihood of binding, and used to try and actually predict the strength of that binding, so the binding affinity of that ligand. So they're really used for a lot of different tasks. And that brings us on to, and so that's sort of a very brief overview of the sort of techniques that are used in computer-aided drug design, particularly in virtual screening. And so with that in place, I'd like to finally talk about how machine learning methods are being used in drug discovery, particularly for this virtual screening process. Just context, statistical modeling and machine learning are well-established tools in drug discovery. I could give you an exhaustive list of things that people have done in the past 30 years, but just a few examples. Using representations such as the molecular fingerprints we introduced earlier as features for support vector machines, it has been successfully used for virtual screening. For example, by Deborah et al. In 2018, an interesting example of substituting secondary assays with computational methods has been the use of decision tree classifiers to try and predict whether or not a molecule passes the blood-brain barrier, which is a very important topic in pharmacology. And just as a third example of this, Korf and Sander in 2006 wrote a very good paper on the use of naive Bayes classifiers to try and predict whether a molecule is likely to be toxic or not. So and these are just a few examples of the things that people have applied machine learning to sort of historically in this field. But in recent years, there's been a lot of interest in the use of machine learning in drug discovery. And arguably one of the big reasons for this is the ever-increasing quantity of data that's actually available, and the ability of traditional methods such as, you know, using a linear regression to fit a scoring function. It simply can't leverage all the data that's available. So just give a feel for the sort of data that's available. Some of the publicly available databases might be a database known as Zinc, which contains 230 million commercially available compounds with 3D conformation of the ligand ready to use in docking, and a further 750 million compounds that are known to be commercially available. The idea being that you can take your compounds from Zinc, you can screen them, and you know you can go and buy them somewhere. Another example of this is a database known as Kembl, which records biological assay data, so measuring do things interact, which contains around 17 million biological activities, you know, how strongly do things bind, for 2 million different compounds across around 14,000 targets. So that really is an enormous amount of data that you might use to try and fit some predictive model. And thinking about structure-based drug discovery, a database known as PDBBind is the largest collection of solved structures of bound protein ligand complexes. It contains around 18,000 of these complexes ready to train structure-based screening models. So that's a lot of data, but just to give a feel for whether this data really is representative of chemistry, and indeed if this data can be representative of chemistry. One thing that's quite interesting to do is to say, okay, I know what properties a drug-like molecule typically exhibits, and this puts constraints on things like the size of the molecule. Based on that, you can sort of use combinatorics to estimate what is the size of the space of molecules that could possibly exist and be drug-like. And a very common estimate of the size of this space is 10 to the power of 60 molecules. That is enormous. That is impossibly enormous. Just to give an idea of how impossibly enormous that is, you can do, if you're boring like me, you can sit down and do a back of envelope count estimate of how many atoms are in the solar system, and you arrive at a figure of around 10 to the 57 atoms in the solar system. There are potentially 1,000 times as many drug-like molecules that you could possibly be interested in as there are atoms in the solar system. It is a physical impossibility to make all of these molecules. So this raises a very important question of, is this data, can this data be relied on to be truly representative? The answer to that is, it's a question and it's something that needs to be borne in mind. But nevertheless, the availability of this data has really spurred a lot of use of machine learning. Of course, complex machine learning methods require robust validation. It's not enough to fit a linear regression on 100 data points and test it on another 100 anymore. Some examples of data sets that have been used for this in drug discovery is, for example, a database known as the Directory of Useful Decoys, which consists of 102 different protein targets with a total of 22,000 ligands spread across those targets and around a million of what are known as decoys. And these are molecules that are believed to not bind to those targets. The idea being that you now have a large data set that simulates the real world situation of a large compound library with a small number of binders. And you can use this to test your algorithm to see, does it rank the binders more highly than the non-binders? One of the obvious issues with this is potential biases that make it artificially easy to identify decoys, and several people such as Rohrer and Bowman in 2009 have come up with various ways of ensuring that ligands are embedded next to decoys in chemical space to make them hard to differentiate, but it's very much an ongoing area of research. And finally, specific to the task of actually developing a good scoring function, Cheng et al. In 2009 started what's known as the Comparative Assessment of Scoring Functions, or CASF. This was to derive a set of PDB-bind-derived complexes with affinity measurements that you can use to directly measure how well does my scoring function predict binding affinity. And it's sort of become a de facto standard in the field. And it's something that will crop up again. I'd like to focus in particular on the use of machine learning to develop scoring functions, because this is something I've worked on over the course of my DPhil, and it's still very much an active area of research. And just to establish why in particular this problem has drawn a lot of attention, the classical scoring functions used in docking are often very good at saying whether a predicted binding pose is good and identifying binders over non-binders. But the energies that they estimate often completely fail to correlate with the actual experimentally observed binding affinity, and so their application in actually measuring affinity is incredibly limited. Now, in the last decade or so, starting around 2010, many different machine learning approaches have been shown, using all sorts of featurizations and algorithms, have been shown to consistently outperform these classical scoring functions at the affinity prediction task on common benchmark sets such as CASF. Just to emphasize, these have all relied on engineered features such as counting how many pairwise interactions are there between atoms in the protein and ligand, or fingerprints describing those protein ligand interactions. So the human bias there, engineering those features. And in addition to this, a lot of these methods appear to be strongly dependent on the data they're trained on and often generalize poorly to unseen targets, which is not ideal given that in the real world, we're trying to screen ligands against a potentially novel drug target. And these scoring functions, although primarily optimized for predicting affinity, have been applied to the virtual screening classification task of identifying binders. But again, they perform on an unseen novel target. And finally, sort of quite an important concept here is most of these studies have relied on training and validating using only experimentally determined binding poses of ligands, so determined by crystallography. And only a few have explored how models can be expected to perform on docked poses, even though in reality, in a virtual screening campaign, you don't have crystal structures of all of your protein ligand complexes, because if you do, you already bind, so you don't need to screen them. And this leads on to some of the work that I did during my DPhil. And the first thing I'd like to just briefly mention is one of the things we looked at was aggregating structure-based and ligand-based methods using random forests, and just want to, the figure on the right is just a brief illustration of, don't worry about the details, so the solid lines indicate the correlation obtained by method combining structure and ligand-based information. The dotted lines indicate the corresponding method using only the structure-based information. We found that regardless of how you train and validate the model, a model using both structure and ligand-based information was consistently superior at predicting the protein ligand binding affinity. However, regardless of the features and algorithm used, the again, as mentioned previously, the similarity between your training and validation data had a strong influence on your model performance. This is a problem that clearly needs to be addressed. One of the common criticisms of machine learning is it has a somewhat earned reputation as a black box. It's not entirely true, though. An advantage of the random forest algorithm, for example, is the ability to actually look at the importance of each feature in the model. And indeed, in our work, what we found when we inspected this was that, again, regardless of how you're training the model, both ligand-based and structure-based information was consistently found to be important in making these predictions. So on the right, the red and yellow bars, the importance of structure-based features, the blue bars are the importance of ligand-based features. And no matter how you train the model, you'd consistently see this combination of features being important, suggesting that they're capturing useful orthogonal information. Another thing that we looked at was this problem of, well, how do we do in the real world on docked poses rather than crystal poses, allowing for the fact that the docked poses might not necessarily be that accurate. And again, don't worry about the details, but in the figure on the right, the solid lines correspond to a model that was trained and validated using experimentally determined poses. The dotted line is the same model that was trained and validated using docked poses, some of which were really good, some of which were not so good. And again, what jumped out to us was, firstly, regardless of how you trained and validated the model using crystal poses was always performing better than the model using docked poses, sometimes by a little, sometimes by quite a lot. So it clearly has an impact on the model. It gives you an overly optimistic estimate of how you're going to do in the real world. But in addition to this, what we also found was that the relative drop in performance of a hybrid method that was using both structural and ligand-based information was much smaller when using docked poses than that of a model using only structure-based information, which intuitively makes sense. Information about the ligand is independent of that pose, so it appears that it helps to actually compensate for errors introduced when you're using these imperfect docked poses. And indeed, we had a look at what happened when we provided multiple training examples of the same ligand in different docked poses to try and see, does seeing different docked poses help or hurt the algorithm? And what we actually found was that, one, the performance of the model, regardless of how it was trained, consistently dropped when it was given multiple examples of poses for a ligand. But also, when this happened, the ligand-based features in the model became far more important, in many cases dominated its ability to make predictions. So corroborating this idea that when you have noise introduced through docking errors, leveraging ligand-based methods that you know work can really help to recover your performance. And you know, this sort of illustrates the advantage of using a more interpretable algorithm. It really allows you to drill into the model and see what's going on, why is your performance being affected. So as I've alluded to, what we've observed and others have found is that your performance often depends greatly on the target of interest, and that generalizing to novel data can be incredibly challenging, even if your model appears to perform well, which is really quite damning when you think about the real world application to a novel drug target. What we also found was that performance gain on standard benchmarks like CASF, when you add more training data, could often be attributed not to having more data, but similar to the data you add being similar in some way to the data in that benchmark set, you know, different ligands binding against the same protein. And as soon as you remove that similar data, even if you have more data, you're back to where you were with the smaller data set. So it suggests sort of an artificial performance gain that's masking what's really going on. And this is, I'd just like to sort of leave this there, but this is a really glaring problem. And it's one that clearly can't be addressed by simply getting all better and better on a standard benchmark. And this is still very much an active area of research. So Moa, we started a little bit late. So I'd like to just sort of quickly introduce some recent developments in applying deep learning to drug discovery, both to this virtual screening task, but also some really interesting ideas about molecule generation that's been enabled by deep learning techniques. So clearly we're not all the way there, even with machine learning scoring functions. They depend on well-engineered features. Even good features can introduce human biases. What we'd ideally like to be able to do is find some way of taking a raw representation of the data without human bias and getting a model to learn for itself what a molecule looks like, what an interaction looks like, what a bad interaction looks like. And this is the natural application of deep learning. You know, you let the model engineer features for itself in a hierarchical manner. There have been all sorts of applications to deep learning to task in drug discovery, for example, solubility prediction, toxicity prediction, predicting reaction outcomes for synthesis planning. Again, going back to the idea of it doesn't matter how good the ligand is if you can't synthesize it to test it. Molecular design using reinforcement learning, so iteratively modifying the molecule to make it better, and also improving docking and virtual screening results. And in the last few minutes, I'm just going to talk about some recent work from the Oxford Protein Informatics Group that's touched on applying deep learning to drug discovery. And so the first piece of work that came out of the group was a piece of work by former OPIC, Fergus Imrie, in 2018, where they used a convolutional neural network. You can take a 3D structure of a protein ligand complex, split it up into different atom types. For example, there are, you know, where the aliphatic carbons and the structures are in the protein and the ligand are, and generating from this sort of voxel maps of the density of these atoms in that structure. And then you can treat these voxelized maps as analogous to color channels in an RGB image. So in an RGB image, you have your really three bitmaps, one for red, one for green, one for blue, that builds up the total image. Here you can have these maps of where different atom types are that together represent a full protein ligand complex. And then with this fixed size 3D representation, you now have a representation of the data that feeds quite naturally into the convolutional neural networks that have been applied successfully in computer vision tasks, you know, image recognition, video processing, things like this. And this was shown by David Coez et al. In 2017 to be quite effective for virtual screening. The piece of work that Fergus Imrie did was taking these convolutional neurons and applying architectural advancements from computer vision, in this case using densely connected layers in the network, to see if this improved your ability to screen compounds, as it had been shown to improve the ability to classify images. And indeed, they found that by introducing these densely connected blocks exactly as you would in computer vision, you immediately get an improvement in your virtual screening performance, suggesting that this task does actually work as a computer vision task. However, some early analysis of these sorts of CNNs revealed that oftentimes the CNN was actually just using the channels that represent the ligand to make its predictions. You know, it's implicitly learning biases about the ligands, even though it's not been given engineered information about them. And it wasn't actually using the structure of the protein. Some work by a current member of OPIG, Jack Scantlebury, however, showed that by taking your training, augmenting by taking your known binders, repositioning the ligand in obviously unphysical poses and labeling these as non-binders, you force the network to classify them as incorrect and thereby force it to use the structure of the protein to differentiate between these two different poses of the bound ligand. And so what they found was that if you don't do this augmentation on the right, you basically get the same information, the same result, whether you use the structure of the protein or not. However, in this figure in the middle, what they find is if you do this data augmentation, you force the model to actually use the information about the structure, your model generalizes a lot better. This looks like in the image on the bottom, the third image on the bottom row here, we have a ligand sitting in an active site of a target, and red parts of this image correspond to parts of the structure that were masked during the test process, and so the model wasn't able to use it. Areas in green indicate things that contributed favorably to the prediction, areas in red contributed unfavorably. What we see is the network was trained this augmented data, favorable hydrogen bonds indicated by the yellow dots and the green areas positively. So it's learning to make the prediction for the right reason. However, in the other images where you're not using this form of data augmentation, you're still getting correct predictions, but you're making these predictions for the wrong reasons. You're not actually learning that those interactions are there. So clearly this is a key component of training these models. Just to, again, conscious we started a little bit late, so I'm going to gloss over this a little bit at the end, but something that I've been working on recently with a Part 2 student, Oliver Turnbull, in the department, is this idea of, well, okay, we've seen that this sort of data augmentation helps your model generalize for virtual screening classification. Can we leverage that to perform better at a regression task? Now, in regression, it's not clear how you would label an unphysical pose, because you can't just label it as bind or no. You have to give it a binding affinity value, and it doesn't make sense to assign that to an unphysical pose. So how you do that data augmentation is not clear. But what you can do is use transfer learning, take that model that was trained for the virtual screen, the classification task, that's adopted that generalizability, and then use transfer learning to fine-tune the final layer using a regression data set such as PDB bind, to train that final layer for the regression task and see if you actually retain the benefit of that data augmentation. And so this is something that Oliver looked at recently. What we had a look at is, if you perform the same masking process using a network that was fine-tuned from Jack Scantlebury's network, you get something on the left where we have a ligand that we know binds with a certain binding affinity. And again, we can mask atoms and see atoms that appear as green here are those that contributed favorably to the final affinity prediction. Things that are in red are those that contributed unfavorably. And what we see on the left is, when we fine-tune a model that's had that data augmentation applied, the model is correctly learning where important hydrogen bonds are. It's clearly rewarding those interactions being present and penalizing parts of the molecule that don't contribute to those sorts of interactions. On the right, when we just train the same neural network from scratch, purely for affinity prediction, no data augmentation, what we see, even though we got a correct prediction for this compound, what we see is that actually there's no real rhyme or reason to what atoms or parts of the protein the network thought were important for predicting binding affinity. For example, up here we have what should be an important bond is marked as completely unfavorable. And that down here, what should be an important patch on the protein surface, again, is not contributing strongly. So clearly this network can actually retain some of that information from the virtual screening data augmentation process when you fine tune it for this regression process. So this seems to be a really promising lead for actually improving your ability to predict binding affinity in this virtual screening setting. So I was going to talk a little bit about molecule design, but I don't want to. I want to make sure we stop in reasonable time, so I'm going to gloss over that. But if you want to ask about it, feel free. But just to sort of emphasize what we've learned so far from all the experiments that people have done on this topic, is machine learning methods at this stage are ubiquitous in drug discovery, and they often outperform traditional methods, either in accuracy or accomplishing the same task faster and cheaper. For example, virtual screening versus high throughput screening, computational synthesis planning versus having a chemist plan out the synthesis of every single compound. And although they have a reputation as uninterpretable black boxes, actually using appropriately chosen algorithms or sensible approaches to exploring your data can actually make your model quite interpretable, giving you insight into how predictions are being made, whether the molecule is actually learning the underlying biophysics or simply spurious correlations in the data. And sort of on that note, deep learning, provided you perform careful data augmentation and training of the model, can enable virtual screening with a model that learns directly from the underlying data what favorable interactions look like without inheriting human biases from engineered features, regardless of how sensible or good those might be. And something I'd like to mention, even though we don't have time to talk about it, is generative models such as graph-gated neural networks, which are used to build up graphs. You can represent a molecule as a graph and use something like a graph-gated neural network to rapidly elaborate from that graph to generate possible new molecules, which gives you a new way of exploring, coming back to this idea of chemical spaces and possibly vast. Gives you another effective tool for exploring chemical space in a way that a chemist might not be able to on paper. all of this work's also raised some important questions and challenges. And as I alluded to when I spoke about the size of chemical space, is this question of, is our available data sufficient for our purposes and sufficiently representative of chemical space to actually allow us to truly train generalizable models that can actually perform these sorts of tasks without inheriting human biases? Another important question is, that sort of underpins all of this, is can we currently rely on protein ligand docking to generate binding poses that are accurate and useful enough to enable all of these machine learning models to work effectively? A common maxim in machine learning, of course, is garbage in, garbage out, and this most certainly applies here. Another very important question that I alluded to previously with molecular dynamics is all of these methods for virtual screening and predicting binding affinity fundamentally operate from a static snapshot of the protein ligand complex, a single docked pose. But in reality, molecular interactions is a very dynamical biological process. You know, things are wobbling around. And so does it really make sense to expect to be able to solve this problem using a single static snapshot? Or do we need to explore this these dynamic processes more? And finally, we've seen a lot of promising work with deep learning methods being able to not only screen molecules, but indeed generate new molecules. So can we expect deep learning methods to fully remove the need for slow and costly human involvement in things like design and synthesis planning? Or do we still need the expert human on hand in order to guide this process? And so I'd just like to wrap up there. So I'd like to thank the entire of the Octave Protein Informatics group. As you can see, we're all looking very professional on the right-hand side. But in particular, former and present members, Fergus Imrie, Tom Hadfield, Jack Scantlebury, and Oliver Turnbull, whose work has underpinned a lot of the things that I've spoken about today, particularly on the deep learning side of things. And finally, thanks to Garrett and Beverly for inviting me to speak today, and thanks for all of you for listening to me. So I'd like to leave it there, and we have some time available. I'd like to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Fergus. That was wonderful. And I invite everyone to use your yellow or whatever preferred color clapping hand symbols to indicate your appreciation. And I will stop recording now.